All right. So last week we focused on Rashi. We discussed the fact that while Rashi was the first rabbinic scholar in Northern Europe to write a systematic and methodical commentary on the Torah, paying attention equally to both its legislative and narrative portions, he surely wasn't the first rabbinical scholar in Northern Europe to be interested in Tanakh. And indeed, there was interest in Tanakh, even interest in what we would call parshanut, biblical interpretation, in Northern Europe prior to Rashi. But as I said, Rashi nevertheless was still the first person to do it, to go about the task of interpreting the Tanakh in a systematic and methodical fashion. We mentioned that prior to Rashi, there were two major schools of thought regarding Tanakh, one of which was situated in the south of France, in Provence, more specifically in the city of Narbonne. And in the generation before Rashi, it was personified in the work of a particular scholar named Rabbi Moshe, who has come to be known, because Rashi quotes him, as Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan. That is to say, Rabbi Moshe, whose approach to the study of Tanakh focused primarily on Midrashim. Elsewhere in France, at reasonably the same time, there was another school of thought whose approach to Tanakh was more linguistic, bordering on literary, and it was represented in the work of a particular scholar named Rabbi Menachem Varchelbo. And when Rashi made reference to him, it was always as Rabbi Menachem Patar, Rabbi Menachem interpreted, since the collection or anthology of his personal insights, original insights into Tanakh, were called Pitronim, interpretations. So that Rashi didn't come into a void, so to speak. But what Rashi did was Rashi tried to synthesize those two approaches that existed before him. So that Rashi, and we read this in his commentary on Breshit, Perek Gimel Pasuk Chet, where he told us that there are many Agadic Midrashim, that there are many Agadic Midrashim, but that the rabbis, his predecessors, had organized them into Midrashic anthologies. That would be Rashi's nod in the direction of the school of Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan. But then Rashi said, Va'ani, whereas I, Lovati Ella, I have come as a biblical exegete, only Lipshuto Shel Mikra, to give an interpretation of Tanakh that is closer to the dictionary definitions of words and further from their midrashic interpretations. And that is Rashi's nod in the direction of Rabbi Menachem Varchelbo and his fellow Potrim. Whether Rashi was successful in finding that balance between Peshat and Darash is, as I mentioned, a toss-up, and I mentioned that there are two schools of thought in that regard as well. One of which says that Rashi only resorts to Midrash when the Pshat is inadequate to the exegetical task, meaning if Rashi quotes a Midrash, then there's a problem in the Pasuk that is not resolved otherwise. While another school of thought says, no, Rashi gives interpretations that are simple and straightforward. And if he quotes a midrash, it's not for the purpose of commentary. It is a didactic purpose, right? It's to teach us something, a moral, ethical, moral, religious, spiritual message. Okay. This evening, we will pick up with the generation following Rashi, and we will follow it for another two generations past Rashi while remaining in northern France. So we will look first at Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, who was Rashi's grandson. We will look at Yosef Kara, who was in the generation between Rashi and Rashbam. And then we'll look at Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, who was a student of Rabbeinu Tam, who was Rashbam's brother, which makes him the following generation. So if we go Rashi, Yosef Kara, Rashbam, Yosef Bechor Shor, we will have looked at four consecutive generations of biblical commentators in northern France. So let's start with Rashbam and with Rashbam's presentation of his methodological approach to Tanakh. Now, you might wonder why it's not in his commentary at the very beginning of the Torah. The answer to that I actually gave last week when I called your attention to the fact that Rashi did not write an introduction to his commentary on the Torah. That in fact, the only one of the 24 biblical books to which Rashi wrote an introduction was Shir HaShirim. That seems to be because in northern France, it simply was not expected of, and therefore authors were not accustomed to writing introductions. That's a very different situation from the one that we already saw in the Middle East, in Sa'adya Gaon, and the one that we will see subsequently in Muslim Spain, in Ibn Ezra, and in Christian Spain, in Rambam, where unlike France, in Spain and in North Africa and in the Middle East, the customary literary style was to write introductions. So Rashbam did not write an introduction to his commentary. But there another reason why this comment is kind of stuck here in the middle of his commentary on Breshit Perek Lamed Zayin, and that is because the history of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah is very different from that of Rashi's commentary. You may remember that I mentioned last week that in 1940, to mark the 900th anniversary of Rashi's birth, a lot of Jewish scholarly organizations published books on Rashi. And in one collection of articles about Rashi, somebody provided a list of all of the manuscripts of Rashi's commentary on all or part of Tanakh, at least those that were so identified in the collections of well-known libraries throughout the world. And that list of commentaries, of Rashi's commentary on Tanakh in whole or in part, reached over 300. I also mentioned that the earliest printed Hebrew book to carry a date was Rashi's commentary on the Torah. So we see that almost from its inception, Rashi's commentaries on Tanakh were immensely popular. They were copied laboriously by hand. They were printed. And in fact, if scholarship faces a task in the 21st century, the task is born of an embarrassment of riches. There are just so many manuscripts of Rashi's commentary and so many early printed editions that frequently it's difficult to determine which of them, in case there are differences, which of them is the most correct. Rashbam's commentary on the Torah was never published, never printed until the 19th century. And that's because until the 19th century, it didn't exist. Didn't exist means that while portions of it were quoted by later commentators, the sole surviving manuscript of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah was only discovered, or if you wish, identified by a German Jewish scholar named Rosen in the second half of the 19th century. And on the basis of that sole surviving manuscript, he prepared the first, and since then, one of the few printed editions. That sole surviving manuscript doesn't even exist today, since we don't know whether during the Holocaust it was destroyed or whether it was put into safekeeping, and one way or the other, it's been lost. Which, of course, raises a fascinating question. It's not as though Rashbam was an unknown quantity. Even before his commentary was discovered, everybody knew who Rashbam was. He was known as one of Rashi's illustrious grandchildren. He was known as the brother of Rabbeinu Tam, who replaced Rashi as the leading rabbinic scholar in Northern Europe in the 12th century. He was known as the person who had completed portions of Rashi's commentary on the Talmud. So it's not as though Rashbam was unknown. It's not as though people didn't hold Rashbam in high regard as a commentator. But yet the fact of the matter is that his commentary was copied, apparently, so few times that very few, and eventually only one copy of it, remained. Whether that's an accident, or whether that is the result of a deliberate attempt to suppress his commentary, we'll get to a little later this evening. But for the time being, this, which looks like an introduction to his commentary on the Torah, happened in that manuscript to be at the beginning of the Sidra of Vayeshev. And Rashbam addresses himself in this introduction to people whom he calls Ohavei Seichel, rationalists. Okay. And he says that rationalists will understand that which our rabbis have taught us, namely that Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuta. As we worked on this 2 weeks ago, I offer the translation of no verse can be purged of its literal sense. Meaning, even on the certain conditions or circumstances, if you prefer a non-literal interpretation, you can't just make believe that the literal sense doesn't exist. You can't ignore it. Okay. So, why does Rashbam have to remind us of this rule that no verse can be purged of its literal sense? He tells us that in spite of the fact that the essence of Torah is to teach us Haggadot, that's moral lessons, Halachot and Dinim, legal lessons, the Torah accomplishes this by means of either allusions in the literary sense, that is, doesn't necessarily have to spell it out, but it can do it in a somewhat oblique fashion, all right? Or through redundancy, that is through repetition. Or how else do we derive law, halacha, from a Torah text? We do it through the application of what are called midot shehatorah nidreshet bahem, hermeneutic rules. Therefore, says Rashbam, harishonim, my predecessors. And that doesn't just mean Grandpa Rashi, it means going back through the generations, even into the time of the Talmud and into the Mishnah, right? He says that the ancients, mitoch hasidutam, out of piety, preoccupied themselves with the hermeneutics, with the derashot, that is to say, with deriving halacha from the Torah text. Why? On account of their preeminence, shehenikar. But as a result of the fact that they preoccupied themselves with understanding the legal parts of the Torah, lo hurgelu ba'omek pshuto shel mikra. They simply were not able to accustom themselves or familiarize themselves with understanding the text.
So put it back.
Literally. Okay. Now, why might that be? Why might they have limited their study of Torah to the legal portions? He tells us because the Talmud seems to incline in that direction. There's a Talmudic statement that says, "Al tarbu b'neichem b'hi gayom." Don't let your children indulge excessively in higayom, which can either mean speculation or recitation, which Rashi, in his commentary on that passage in the Talmud, identifies with Bible study. And much more clearly, the Talmud also says that somebody who studies Tanakh, who studies Mikra, he says, midah ve'na midah, it has advantages and disadvantages. But the study of Talmud, on the other hand, ein lecha midah gdola mizo, that the value of Talmud study is surpassed. So clearly, the Talmud inclines more towards the study of the Talmud, right, than of the study of Tanakh. Therefore, says Rashbam, mitoch kach, on account of this inclination, lo hurgalu kol kach bipshutan shel mikraot, they simply did not accustom or familiarize themselves to understanding scripture on a more literal basis. In fact, says Rashbam, and we actually have seen this passage before, he says, even my grandfather Rashi, whom he calls Meir Einei Gola, right? The luminer, the one who illuminates the eyes of the Jews in exile, right? Sheperesh Torah Nevi'im Ktuvim, who wrote a commentary on the entire Tanakh. He says, my grandfather set a new trend, Natan Lev Lefaresh Pshuto Shel Mikra. He at least paid attention to understanding Tanakh on a more literal level. However, he says, Ani Shmuel ben Meir Chatanozatzal, I, his grandson, nitvakachti imo ulefanav. I challenged him. I disputed some of his interpretations. And the result, says Rashbam, is hodali, that Rashi admitted, she'ilu ayalo pnai, that if he only had time, hayat sarich la'asod perushim acherim, he would have to write other interpretations, meaning interpretations other than the ones that are contained in his commentary. Why? Lefi ha'pishatot ha'mitchadashim b'chol yom. Because one can obtain new insight. While halacha is unchanging, one's understanding of the literal sense of a pasuk can change from day to day. We see the same thing reflected here in a fragment of Rashbam. Vos heist a fragment? A fragment is a text attributed to Rashbam that is not part of a larger literary work by Rashbam. This happens to be...
1 minute, David, take this, it up.
Here. Fragment happens to have been appended to a manuscript of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, where on a blank page in a folio, in a codex, right, in a bound volume of Rashi's commentary on Tanakh, there was a blank page following his commentary on the Torah, in which a later scribe, later than the one who copied the commentary itself, added several passages that he attributed to Rashbam. And in one of these passages that I had the good fortune to identify and to publish, he says this about his grandfather. Im yiru haro'im perushim kidumim shenotim letzad pshad acher b'inyanim acherim. If you happen to come across interpretations of earlier commentators that incline towards a different pshat in other matters, yitnu lev, says, take note, ki einam derech eretz lefi chochmat divrei v'nei adam o keferush hapasuk. Rashbam says, be very careful, and when you come across another interpretation, examine it to make sure that it is consistent with both what he calls Derech Eretz, which means the way things are in real life, and that it's also consistent, Kepei Rosh HaPasuk, that it fits into the context of the verse. To whom is he referring when he says these earlier commentaries that by implication are not necessarily in line with these two criteria? Halo tir'eh ma peresh zekeni zatzal. He says, let's take as an example something that my grandfather wrote. Now, I didn't cite the commentary here. I should have. I actually had prepared it for last week because it fits with Tu Bishvat. But unfortunately, I neglected to transfer the slide. So you'll just have to take my word for it. The verse that Rashi commented on, to which Rashbam is responding here, is the verse in Sefer Devarim that says, Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, right? That's the well-known phrase in the verse. Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, right? If we take only that fragment out of context, it means that people and trees are alike. Okay? Now, if we take the context of the entire verse, it's situated in a discussion about the laws of warfare. And the Torah says that when you are besieging a city, it is prohibited to cut down fruit-bearing trees. Okay? Lo tashchit etza lindoach alav garzen, ki mimena tochal. You cannot cut down fruit-bearing trees because ultimately when you are successful in the conquest, you're going to want to use those fruit-bearing trees, okay? Then the Torah says, however, a tree that is not a fruit-bearing tree, okay, oto tichrot, you may cut down non-fruit-bearing trees. It's in this context that the Torah says, Ki ha'adam etz ha'sadeh lanus mipanecha b'matzor. Because a tree of the field is like a human being when it comes to trying to escape from the siege. Rashi's understanding of the verse is the one that you very frequently hear on Tu Bishvat, which is, why are we so concerned about and involved with trees? Because ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, because trees are like people. Take a look carefully, see what Rashbam says about that interpretation that Rashi gave. He says, halo ze hadavar hevel. He says, basically, that is nonsense. He says, nobody thinks that trees are people. Then he offers his own interpretation of the verse, Vani perashtiv yafeh lufi hapsukim. He gave it a contextual interpretation, ulefi derech eretz, and his interpretation was consistent with realia, with reality. Okay. Hare perusho lufi hapsukim shelema'ala v'derech eretz udvar chochma. Because you cannot take a phrase out of context and interpret it without regard to the context in which it appears. Just to add, just to complete the circle, what was Rashbam's interpretation? Rashbam's interpretation pointed out that the word ki in ki ha'adam etz ha'sadeh is preceded by the word lo. And we know that every time the word ki is preceded by a particle of negation, the lo plus ki equals rock only. So that's Rashbam's interpretation. You may not cut down a fruit-bearing tree. However, you may cut down a non-fruit-bearing tree, providing lanus mipanecha b'matzor. Providing that non-fruit-bearing tree is providing cover to your enemy. So that it very frequently happens in the Middle East today, where Israel, either in a war or in a military action, will uproot or will destroy trees, right? And there'll be a hue and a cry from the environmentalists, okay? Arguably, Rashbam is addressing such a situation and saying, of course, wanton destruction should not be of non-fruit-bearing trees either. I mean, you don't just simply destroy a tree because because it doesn't produce fruit, okay? If, however, the non-fruit-bearing tree is providing cover to the enemy, lanus mipanecha b'matzor, then Rashbam says the Torah permits its destruction. Here I want to compare Rashbam and Rashi very quickly. On the opening verses in the Sidra of Vayetze, familiar story, Jacob leaves Beersheba, he goes to Haran. Along the way, he stops at a place where he goes to sleep, and he has this wonderful dream where there's a ladder or a ramp, something that gives access from the ground upwards, okay? And on the ladder, there are angels that are both ascending and descending, and God is poised above the ladder or above the ramp, right? And he gives a blessing to Yaakov so that Yaakov wakes up in the morning and he takes the stone that he had placed beneath his head and he stands it up as a monument, and he declares, Ein zekiyim beit Elohim v'zeh shar ha-shamayim. Wonderful. Let's compare Rashi and Rashbam's interpretations of one segment of this story. Okay. The text says, Vayifga b'makom. Sorry, again. Vayifga b'makom. Look at Rashi. Rashi says, b'makom literally means the place. The place implicitly means a place that has definition. Definition means that it's a place I've encountered before. So according to Rashi, where did Yaakov spend the night? He spent the night in the same place where his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham had been previously, i.e., namely, on Har HaMoriah. Rashbam says, any place that you stop at and spend the night acquires definition by virtue of your stopping there and spending the night. And therefore, the place at which Yaakov spent the night and had the dream was non-specific. It was wherever he happened to be. Okay. The verse says that Yaakov stopped there for the night, ki va hashemesh. Now, the word ki, as we pointed out on numerous occasions, can have a variety of different meanings. It can mean when, it can mean if, it can mean other than. So Rashi interprets it as ki va hashemesh, because the sun set, implying that there's something unusual about this sunset. Therefore, Rashi says, following the Midrash, that God caused the sun to set earlier than it would have set otherwise, meaning it was an unseasonable setting. Why? In order to force Yaakov to spend the night there. Rashbam just simply says it means when the sun set, he stopped. Wherever the sun had set, he would have stopped, simply because in those days, people didn't travel at night. Okay? Then the verse says, Vayikach me'avnei ha-makom v'yaseh merashotav. He took from amongst the stones that were available to put beneath his head. How many stones did he have to take in order for the verse to say that he took from amongst the stones of the place? Rashbam says he only needed to take one stone. In fact, says Rashbam, the proof is that it says that when he woke up in the morning, Vayikach et ha-even asher sa merashotav. So Rashbam says, trust me, if there was only one stone there when he woke up in the morning, there was only one stone when he went to sleep the night before. Rashi says, well, you know, the word ne'avne is a plural word. Therefore, Rashi, again following the Midrash, says that Yaakov took several stones and placed them either beneath his head or about his head. And while he was asleep, a miraculous thing happened. Those several stones were fused together. And that's how it came to be that when he woke up in the morning, there was but a single stone. Then the final element that we'll compare is the Torah's description of the activity of the malachim, of the angels, on the ladder as olim v'yoredim. Rashi says that olim v'yoredim is an absolute sequence, meaning first there were angels going up, and only subsequently were there angels coming down. And the Agadah assigns a certain significance to this. It says that first the angels who were accompanying, escorting Yaakov in the land of Israel ascended to heaven, and then those who were supposed to escort him out of the land of Israel and to Haran descended. Rashbam here uses that term of reference that we saw in a previous slide called Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz, the way things are in reality. Rashbam says, I'll put it to you this way. Okay. Without using your hands, just through words, okay, describe the movement of a seesaw. Okay. I think it's going to be very difficult to find somebody who will not say seesaws go up and down. Now, is it necessarily true that every seesaw goes up first and then down? Well, seesaw may not be a good example because seesaws go up and down simultaneously. Try a swing. Okay? Right? Swings go up and down or back and forth. Do they always go back before they go forth? Do they always go up before they go down? No. It's derech eretz. It's a figure of speech. Right? People, when they describe something that moves in two different directions, customarily say back before forth, and they say up before down. Why am I focusing on this? What's the significance to this? The significance is as follows. If we take all four of these comments by Rashi, and we want to characterize them in a single word, that is to say, how in a single word would you characterize Rashi's interpretation of the episode involving Jacob's dream? The answer in a word is miraculous. If we wanted to summarize Rashbam's approach to the same story in a single word, it would be natural. Now, here's a curious question. Which of these two approaches, the miraculous or the natural, has greater potential for educating people, for religious education? The answer that I get most often is, well, of course, Rashi's approach, because Rashi imbues every word and every phrase with religious significance. And I'm here to tell you that I think it's just the opposite. I think that Rashbam's approach, the naturalistic approach to the story of Yaakov, provides the potential for considerably more and better religious education. Why? Because if you hit somebody over the head with God, the sun sets prematurely, the earth skips beneath him, the stones fuse together, right? For somebody who's been hit over the head by God to say, Ein zekim beit Elohim v'zeh shar ha-shamayim, that this is the house of God and this is the gateway to heaven, that's not impressive. It's impressive if somebody under ordinary circumstances will be moved to acknowledge the presence of God. So I think that Rashbam, precisely on account of his very literal approach to the text and his emphasis on Derech Eretz, on the way things are in reality, and on seeing things within their context, provides occasionally even greater pedagogical potential than Rashi. Rashbam even goes so far as to say, "Vafaresh hadinim v'ahalachot l'fi derech eretz," that this idea of prevailing norms of the way things are in reality isn't only a useful way to explain stories, it's even a useful way to explain halacha. And here's an example. The laws of the Eved Ivri provide that at the end of 6 years of service, he goes free. If, however, he wants to voluntarily extend his service, and he says, "Ahavti et Adonai et Ishti ve'et Banai lo etzei chopshi," I like it here, and I don't want to go free, then the Torah says, this, the Torah prescribes a procedure. And the procedure is that his owner takes him to court, where he stands him adjacent to the doorway, and particularly to the mezuzah that's hanging on the door, and he pierces his ear, the slave's ear, with an awl, va'avado le'olam. And then the period of service is extended. The question, of course, is how far is it extended? The Torah says it's extended le'olam, which literally means forever. However, Rashi, as you can see, understands the word lo'olam ad hayovel. Now that's not Rashi's original interpretation. That's the Midrashic and Talmudic understanding that no Jew can be enslaved forever. And even if he decides voluntarily to extend his period of service beyond the initial 6 years, the longest amount of time that he can serve is until the Jubilee year, until the Ovel. And there's biblical proof that the Jubilee year, the Shnat HaYovel, is called Le'olam. Therefore, says the Talmud, and it's repeated here in Rashi, that the Torah's intention is for this indentured servant to continue his period of service only until the Ovel. Rashbam comes along and says, "Lefi hapshat kol yemei chayav," that a simple, literal, straightforward reading of the text means that he should continue to be a slave for the rest of his life. But then Rashbam does something very interesting. He says, "Kamo," he gives us a proof text. And his proof text is, "Kamo sheneemar b'Shmuel," as it is said of Samuel. You remember that when Hannah, Samuel, Shmuel's mother, learned that was praying for a child, she said that if God granted her prayer, then she would devote that child to the service of God, right? V'yashav sham ad olam. And he will remain there in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, ad olam. Now, reasonable question. What was Hannah's intention? Was it her intention that this child would remain in the service of the Mishkan until the Jubilee year? Or was it her intention that he should remain in the service of God his whole life? Arguably, Rashbam is correct. And Hannah's intention was that he should remain in God's service forever, meaning his whole life, which would be a strong proof for his interpretation. Except for one very interesting thing. According to Talmudic and Midrashic chronology, Samuel lived 52 years. according to a reasonably straightforward reading of the text of the book of Samuel, when did his mother return him to Shiloh to serve in the Mishkan? When he was weaned, which arguably would be at the age of 2. So the interesting thing is that Samuel, how many years did Samuel actually spend in service to God in Shiloh? 50 years. So when Rashbam cites Samuel as evidence that the word la'olam means forever, it's very possible that he knew that Samuel in reality spent 50 years in service to God in Shiloh, which means that in the case of Samuel, forever and until the Yovel year happened to be the same thing. Here, just very quickly again, Vayikra 13 is the laws of Mitzorah, Tzara'at. And notice here Rashbam says that I have nothing to say about this because, he says, there's no derech eretz, meaning nobody knows and nobody in the Middle Ages knew any longer just exactly what Tzara'at was. And therefore, says Rashbam, if it doesn't exist in reality, then we can't give a realistic interpretation of it. Therefore, he says, the only interpretation that we can give of the laws of Tzara'at are the ones that have already been given by the Talmud and the Midrash. One final feature of Rashbam that I want to note is that Rashbam also seems to have developed beyond Rashi in terms of his appreciation of the style of biblical Hebrew. He had a keener literary sense than Rashi. Here we have the testimony of a later French author, Rabbi Chaim Paltiel, who lived in the latter half of the 13th century, who wrote this apropos of his commentary on a verse in Vayechi that says, Ben Porat Yosef, Ben Porat Ale Ayin. Okay? The thing to note is, of course, the repetition. Ben Porat, Ben Porat. Okay? It's ostensibly redundant. Okay? So Rabbi Chaim Paltiel says, Derech HaPasuk, that it is the manner, it is part of scriptural style, it's biblical style, to do what? Latchil devaro ve'eino gomra, to start something and not complete it. V'acharkach, and then subsequently, gomer, to complete it. And what example does he give? Nas'u naharot kolam. Of course, that's the end of the verse, right? The beginning is Nas'u Naharot Hashem, Nas'u Naharot Kolam, right? Meaning, first it says Nas'u Naharot, the rivers raised up, but it doesn't say what they raised up. Later, it completes it. It says, what did the rivers raise up? Kolam, they raised their voice. Or, later in that same, not the same chapter, but the same context, it says, Kihine oivecha Hashem. Behold your enemies, God. Behold what about them? It continues and says, Kihine oivecha yovedu. Your enemies will be destroyed. So he says, this is the same thing here. Bein porat Yosef. Yosef is a bein porat. What does that mean? It continues and it says, Bein porat ale ayin. Okay. So he says, this is a feature of biblical poetry. And then he says at the very end, he says, Kol zeh, he says, this observation of this feature of biblical poetry, Miyasod Rabbeinu Shmuel, right? We attribute it to Rabbeinu Shmuel. That would be Rashbam. And he adds the following interesting biographical note. He says, Kshahaya Rashi Zekeno Magia Lootam Psukim, that when Grandpa Rashi was discussing these kinds of biblical verses, Haya Koreotam Psukei Shmuel, he would call them Shmuel's verses, meaning that Rashi acknowledged that his understanding and appreciation of this literary phenomenon was due to his grandson Rashbam. And indeed, if we take a look here in a portion of a commentary on Kohelet that is attributed to Rashbam, Havel Havalim Amar Kohelet, Kohelet made some observation on the nature of vanity. But it doesn't say what his observation was. It then continues and says, Havel Havalim, Hakol Havel. So this again is an example of this same kind of biblical style. And notice, the citations, the proof text that he gives here are the same ones that were cited previously by Rabbi Chaim Paltiel. Nasu Naharot en Kihine Oyevecha. While I was on the subject of the commentary on Kohelet that's attributed to Rashbam, I keep saying attributed because, there's a Talmudic phrase, don't put your head between the two rocks, okay? I'm not going to put myself in the middle of a significant difference of opinion between two great Bible scholars, okay? There is a difference of opinion amongst Bible scholars as to whether this commentary that is attributed to Rashbam on Kohelet is actually his or not. So for the sake of just simply not getting stuck there, I'll just call it the attributed commentary. At the very end of chapter 12, which is the last chapter in the book of Kohelet, there is a repetition of the phrase, Havel Havalim Amar Kohelet, Havel Havalim Hakol Havel. Just the way the book starts, it finishes, okay? Notice what Rashbam says here. He says, Otan asher sidruhu amru mikan ulahaba. That the concluding verses of the book of Kohelet were added by those who redacted it. This, of course, is one of the reasons that the attribution of this commentary to Rashbam is questionable, because this looks like too radical a statement for a 12th century rabbinic scholar. What 12th century rabbinic scholar would openly acknowledge that there were books of the Bible that weren't written by the people to whom they are attributed by the Talmud? So when it says here that the last verses in Kohelet were not written by the author of Kohelet, but who was traditionally, right, King Solomon, but they were added by whoever edited or redacted the book, right? Some people see this as grounds to deny Rashbam's authorship of it. The curious thing is that if we take a look, we actually find that other northern French commentators made similar remarks. Here we have Rabbi Yosef Kara, whom we've mentioned before, right? We took a note of his describing somebody who, rather than seeking the pshat, relies implicitly on midrash as somebody who is in water up to his neck, and will seize any piece of floating wreckage to keep his nose above water, meaning it's a last resort. Okay. Here is his commentary on a very interesting verse. In the encounter between an angel of God and the parents of Samson, right, Mr. and Mrs. Manoach, okay, it says that they asked him, What is your name? To which he replied, Lama ze tish'al lishmi v'hu peli. Why are you interested in knowing my name? Why do you ask my name? My name is Peli, which means wondrous or miraculous. Okay? Now, customarily, the customary understanding of this verse is that that was his name. Meaning he was answering the question. He said, I don't know why you would want to know my name, but I can tell you my name. My name is Peli. Okay? Yosef Kara takes a very different approach. First of all, notice that he interprets the verse according to its punctuation. And he observes that the word lishmi in the middle of the verse, nakud be'et nachta, that it's punctuated with an et nachta, which is essentially like a colon. It's the largest pause within a sentence. Vahatam, and this punctuation, mafrido, separates the verse, umamido la'atzmo, and stands it alone, meaning he reads the verse as follows. Lamma ze tishal lishmi. That is what the angel said. The angel said to Manoach and to his wife, you have no business knowing my name. Vuhu Peli is an addition to the text. Somebody else came along later and said, by the way, if you want to know the name of the angel, the name that he wouldn't give to Manoach and his wife, the name happened to be Peli. That's what he says. Hamalach Amarlo, the angel said, Lama ze tishal lishmi. That's the pause in the middle of the verse. Eina tatzarich she'odienu lecha. You have no need to know my name. Vahanavi shekatav et ha-sefer, the author of the book. He acknowledges that it was a prophet, but he's saying it's the author of the book, which would be Samuel, Shmuel Hanavi, Amar v'hu peli. He's the one who added the words to the text. So the idea that later editors or redactors added things of their own into biblical texts, not totally alien to rabbinic scholars of northern France in the 13th century. Here too, in Yosef Kara, again in his commentary elsewhere in Shoftim, he makes reference to Hanavi Shekatab Sefer Zeh, the prophet who wrote this down, meaning this is not an original statement made by one of the judges of Israel, but it's a statement that was made later by whoever it was who recorded these events. And if you say, well, but at least there's an acknowledgement that this was a prophet, when we get to Rabbi Eliezer of Belgency, the French town of Beaugency, who was in a later generation, we find that he's not even that cautious or conservative. And in explaining the very odd change of voice at the beginning of the book of Ezekiel, where first it speaks in the third person about him, and then it talks about him in the first person, he says that the phrases that are entered in the third person about the prophet were not written by Ezekiel himself. Aval ha-sofer shekatav kol dvarav yachad hosif. They were added by whoever was the scribe or the editor who wrote down the words of the prophet. Okay. I see that I've exceeded my own timetable for this evening, so we're going to have to hold off on Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, but we will pay him attention that he deserves at some subsequent point in time. Let me take a look now at the chats. Tell me, Rabbi, I mean, how do you get Zoom to call it a chat room?
I had nothing to do with that. You know, right. Well, we just got rid of, I don't know, there was some blue scribble there before I was asking, and now it disappeared. I don't know if that was just on my screen. All right, you can take a look at the couple.
But it wasn't for me. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It happened once before, and I forget. There's a way to get rid of it, and I don't remember how. So if somebody knows, just let me know. But that's what I put. Anyways, you can take a look at the quick question, comment.
I will yield to Marty Lachin on the subject of Rashbam for almost everything. Yes. Okay. So, all right. So, I'll tell you what. I'm going to take up the rest of the time with just this comment, but I think it deserves it. I did mention along the way that one explanation that was given for the dearth of manuscripts or printed editions of Rashbam's commentary is that it wasn't an accident of history, but rather it was a deliberate attempt to suppress it. Why would someone want to suppress Rashbam's commentary? Because there are portions of Rashbam's commentary that superficially give the appearance of being pardon the expression, antinomian, which means in opposition to the law. We just saw one example. The Talmud says that an indentured Hebrew servant goes free in the Yovel year. Rashbam seems to say, right? Kol Yemei Chayav, right? Forever. Now, I tried to resolve that. I gave us an explanation. That is, I said that when Rashbam added that proof text from the book of Samuel, he was kind of hinting that he also accepts the fact that it only means until the Jubilee year. And that's why the proof text that he brought was of Samuel, who served for 50 years, a Yovel. Okay. There's another Rashbam on the Pasuk that is the source for the laws of Tfilin. Okay. The Torah introduces Tfilin by saying that you should place something as a sign, right, on your arm, la'ot al yadcha, and is something called totafot, beinecha, on your forehead. Let's just assume for a moment that totafot is just a fancy synonym for oat, okay? So the Torah says that something should be placed as a sign upon your arm and upon your forehead, okay? Now, the halacha takes it quite literally, and it says that the sign on your arm and on your forehead consists of the two housings of the parashiyot of the tefillin. Okay? If you look at Rashbam's commentary there, Rashbam explains it by way of a verse in Shir HaShirim, in which the beloved says to her lover, Simeni kachotam al libecha, place me as a seal upon your heart. Surely, says Rashbam, she didn't expect to perform open heart surgery on him, right? Therefore, to place something as a seal or as a sign upon something else need not be understood literally. It can be understood figuratively. What does it mean to place something on your arm or as a sign or on your forehead? It means that this should be as close to you and as meaningful to you as though it were actually, you know, it's kind of like when you tie a string around your finger so you won't forget something. The string has no meaning, right? It's just simply there. You look at it and you say, why did I tie a string around my finger? There's something I have to remember. So it's not the string, right? It's what it represents. Rashbam seems to say the same thing. He says, it's not what I tie around my arm or place on my forehead that's the sign. They're just there like the string around my finger to tell me there's something else that I'm supposed to be thinking of. But the clincher in all of this is Rashbam's commentary in the very first chapter of the book of Genesis on Vayhi Erev Vayhi Voker Yom Echad. And Rashbam points out, and he's absolutely correct, there's no denying it, that the traditional, conventional interpretation of it was night and it was day, one day, meaning, what is the definition of a day according to Jewish law? It's day, the day starts with nightfall, right? Vayhi Erev, it starts with nightfall. And it concludes, right, with nightfall of the following day. That's the classic, conventional, traditional, right, irreplaceable halachic understanding. Rashbam says, excuse me, if that's what the Torah wanted to say, it should have said vayhi laila vayhi yom, meaning there was a laila, a period of nighttime. There was yom, a period of daylight. Yom echad, that's a day. A day consists of a period of darkness followed by a period of light. It's not what it says. Erev means sunset. Boker means sunrise. Therefore, says Rashbam, when does the day end? It ends at sunrise. Meaning, a day, at least Rashbam is cautious. He says, this applies only to the 6 days of creation. Sheshet Yemei Breshit. He says, the 6 days of creation were different. The 6 days of creation were not measured from nightfall to nightfall. They were measured from sunrise to sunrise. This has implications, meaning taken literally, it has immense halachic implications, particularly for the observance of Shabbat. That is why it's claimed that Ibn Ezra devoted a monograph called Igeret HaShabbat, the Shabbos letter, to counteracting this interpretation. Therefore, the claim is that since Rashbam's and several of Rashbam's interpretations were judged to be, that word again, antinomian, right, in contradiction to halacha, a deliberate attempt was made to suppress it. I just want to add one thing in conclusion. First of all, as I said, Rashbam is very careful. He confines this interpretation of Vayera Vayivoker to the 6 days of creation, which means that, strictly speaking, it doesn't affect Shabbat. But it, if you bear it in mind, it will explain something that the Talmud otherwise has no easy way of explaining. And that's Yom HaKippurim. According to the Torah, when does the fast of Yom HaKippurim begin? The Torah says, on the 9th day of the month of Tishrei, Me erev ad erev tishpetu Shabbatchem, that you have to keep the Shabbat of Yom HaKippurim from the erev of the 9th day until the erev of the following day. What's the 9th day have to do with anything? If the day starts with nightfall, then Yom HaKippurim is the 10th day of Tishrei, as we conventionally assume it to be. What's this business of saying B'tish'a lachodesh ba'erev, me'erev ad erev? But if you take Rashbam, and you take Rashbam to mean that actually days only begin with sunrise, so when do we start fasting? We start fasting B'tish'a lachodesh on the day that began in that morning, the sunrise of the 9th day. It's now Erev, it's now the evening, still the evening of the 9th day. Because the 10th day won't really start until dawn of the following day. Therefore, Me Erev ad Erev is easier understood through Rashbam's interpretation than otherwise. How does the Talmud resolve the same problem? You may remember. What? Why do we eat a big meal on the afternoon preceding Yom HaKippurim after we davened mincha? Why do we daven mincha so early on Erev Yom HaKippurim? So that the meal can be eaten as close as possible to sunset. And that's why the Talmud says that if you enjoy a meal, a large meal, in order to prepare yourself for Yom HaKippurim on the 9th day of Tishrei, then it is regarded as though you fasted for 2 consecutive days, ki'ilu tzam tishi'i va'asiri, which means that even the Talmud recognized that the fast of Yom HaKippurim has to begin on the 9th day of Tishrei and is not limited to the 10th day of Tishrei as it would be if it were an ordinary Shabbat. Anyhow, with that, we have to pause.
Yes, okay, thank you very much. Of course, you know, obviously, halachically in the Beit HaMikdash, the day actually does start in the morning. All the halachas of Korbanot, that's, the day actually starts in the morning in the Beit HaMikdash. We've discussed it other times. Yeah, but also, when you can eat a Korban for one day, the one day ends in the morning. It's a totally different schedule. And of course, I forget who published it, but you know that Mark Shapiro was quite upset. He has a long article in the Sfarim blog. Recently they published the Rashbam, and they Taka censored his Perush and the beginning of Bereshit. I forget who recently, in the last year or two, some fancy Chumash, a new version of Mikra Kedoshim was put out. I don't remember the publisher. And they, that part of the Rashbam was censored out, you know, vayhi er, vayhi boker. And, you know, it's, it hasn't stopped, you know, like people don't like, although as Marty Lakshin, you point out, I mean, if those want to listen, you know, Marty Lakshin did give a whole, shiur on the Rashbam. We have it. He did it last year on Zoom. And I think it was great. Many of the examples used were different. It's always great to hear two different speakers speak sort of on the same topic, different perspectives. But Art Scroll published it. I thought so, but I didn't want to say so without confirmation. Thank you. You can listen to that. But also, I believe Marty was talking about the Rashbam says that what he's giving is the pshat of the pasuk, but we don't follow halachically the pshat. For example, ayin tachat ayin. So the Rashbam says ayin tachat ayin means an eye for an eye. That's what it means. Not like
so does Rabbi Eliezer in the Mechilta.
What of ayin tachat ayin?
Eino mishalem ela mamash.
Right, but I don't know. Did Rabbi Eliezer and I don't know. Did he mean it halachically? I'm sorry we're in overtime, but still, do you know? I don't know.
It's there in the Mechilta. You can't erase it. Okay. I guess
I'm going to look it up. You know. Now I have to go look it up in the Mechilta right now.
You need the Horovitz edition of the Mechilta.
I have the Malbim edition of the Mechilta. Will be in there. And then
I don't know.
On the pasuk in Mishpatim. I'll take a look.
Yeah. And no mishalem ela mamash.
Yeah. But I think the Rashbam, when he gives a lot of his, you know, wild, whatever, not wild, normal shratim, whatever you want to call them, he's admitting, like, I remember Marty Lakshin once talking, and this may not have been on Zoom, this may have been a different time in Toronto when he spoke, and he brought in the Rashbam. They were saying, listen, the Ikar learning is Gemara and Drashot. But okay, that's something else. But when I explain Chumash, I have to explain what the pshat said, and that's always, you always have to ask, why did the pshat and the drush?
So if you think, I deal with this, I actually have a book forthcoming called The Pursuit of Pshat. And in it, I explain, one of the things that I explain is that it's partially a question of lower criticism. There's a phrase that Rashbam quotes, and since we don't have the manuscript anymore, we can't check. There's a phrase that says, halacha blank mikra. And the question is whether you fill it in with okevet or okeret. And that's a good deal.
The world of difference.
That's a good deal of it.
Yeah. Okay. To be continued, and we look forward to the Bechor Shor. We can't leave him out. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. We look forward to next week. Tomorrow, 12 noon Eastern Time, Shuli Mishkan, archaeology, biblical archaeology. 8:30 tomorrow night, Rabbi Benji Samuels from Newton, Massachusetts, giving the shir on Pershat Yitro, and then the Maishir on the Siddur on Friday morning, 9 a.m. And Rabbi Liebtag is back this Sunday. Starting a new series, and then all our regular shiurim. And I mentioned earlier today, Malka Simkowitz will be starting a 4-part series on ancient Egypt. She's a scholar, of course, of ancient Judaism. She spoke last year's series, very well received. So she'll be starting Thursday morning at 10:30. So beginning next week, that'll be sort of an hour and a half before Shuli's class, and we'll have a back-to-back, and then, of course, the Parsha at night. Okay, everybody. Invite a friend. That's your job to do, and to invite a friend to join us. We've got some great programming going through the winter, and please go out all the time and let people know about it. Let them join and let them benefit too. Okay, Lila, love everybody, and be well. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you. Kultuv.
Thank you. Kultuv. Thank Rabbi Dr. Sokolov, of course. I'm the Shatchin. That's all. You know, so.
If you pull your Torah's Chaim off the shelf,
which
Dvorim.
Hold on, I'm going to pull it off right now. Shmot Beit, right? The
Mishpat. Dvorim.
Oh, Dvorim.
Dvorim.
Okay, got it. Torah Chaim, let's go. Let's have some fun now that half the people left. Okay.
Look up Rashbam on Lamed Dalet Pasuk Aleph.
Amid Dalit in Dvarim. This is towards the end of the Chumash already. No, that's already the Zohar Bracha. No, still almost Lamed Dalit Aleph. Okay, give me half a second here. Lamed Dalit. Vayal Moshe Me'arbat Moav Al Har Nebo Rosh HaPiska Al Sher Al Pnei Yericho. Vayal Moshe. Kamosha Amarlo HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
Footnote. Look at the footnote. Forget Rashbam. That's not significant. Okay. The footnote is.
HaKitaim Mikan Ve'elech Pursimu. Oh, Al Pi Ktav Yad Al Yedei Mem Sokolov. Ba'al Sefer Yud Aleph Ni Alei Sefer Yud Aleph Nisan Tashin Dalet Mem Tashtam 1984. Amud 77, 78. Ooh. So you made it into Torah time. That's very impressive. Okay.
Yes, any publisher.
Well, last week you translated the Nechama Leibowitz that we found out, and now got to find out all these other things.
Yeah, any publisher except Mossad or Rav Kook would have at least spelled my would put in my whole first name in.
Yeah. So what? Why is that? Why?
They're not. They're, at least they were 1980s. They're
so
not
what happened?
Nice they,
this. Was not in the initial in Rashbam when you found the manuscript? Was that what happened?
As I said, that's the fragment that I described earlier.
That was the fragment you were referring to right here, this whole thing. So, but it's nice they at least they put it in. You know, so, now, K'taim Acherim Shenesvoy Yedei Dalit Rosen. Okay, that's what you mentioned. Hayishmatanu Mifnei Shem Mekoran Eino HaPerush Tepsukim Kan. Very interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right, very, very good. Yes, Yashikoach, thank you. Okay, you have to get a copy of the advanced copy of the book. You know, okay. All right. Thank you very much. We'll see you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.